Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planning leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
There's music coming out of that speaker.
We'll get all the music.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. What do I do with this when I'm done?
Sorry?
What do I do with this when I'm done? Thank you. Gee, they didn't record anything before, so now I got to be like, good. What made you come here? What made you come to this particular workshop? I'd love to hear what your expectations are. When they asked me to do this, they asked it to be more conversational. So in other words, and that's one of the reasons why they put it outside, I think, so it's not just me rambling at you. I can do that. I'm really good at just rambling at you, but I don't want to do that. I'd love to hear a little bit of your expectations, but also be able to answer any questions throughout the time that we talk as well. But so why are you here, besides the fact that it's outside? Yeah, it's kind of like turning a ship. You know, if you can shift cultures of any church, but the bigger, and I guess it's not just the bigger, the longer it's been around, it's like a cruise ship that's trying to turn versus turning a kayak. And what you want is you want to plant it with a certain kind of culture, but that's, you can't go back and do that necessarily. But so that's good. That's good. Somebody else. I'm sorry, you started to say something?
Yeah.
That's good. Well, and sometimes when you multiply a church, you do it with a culture that's ready for it. Other times you do it because you had enough vision and resources, and it can wear you out too. So there's always shifts that are needed culturally to be able to perpetuate what you want. So that's good. Somebody else, why are you here? Right. That's good. And we see a lot of church planting where the vision, and we'll talk about this a little bit more as we go, but the vision is, like, the thought process is, hey, we want to not just do this, we want to be able to reproduce this or start other things from it. But doing it at the beginning, I mean, saying it doesn't necessarily make it happen. So it's hard to set that culture right. So somebody else, why are you here? Yeah, I hear you. My name is Brian Zare. I should have probably introduced myself to you. One of the things that I was a church planter, I was a pastor, and I've also worked as a campus pastor in a multi-site setting. I live in the Chicago area. I used to be the director of training and coaching for New Thing, and I still do a lot of work with them. Right now, I run my own training and coaching firm that basically teaches culture and leadership within the church context. And I used to complain that most churches are led by people who have never had training in leadership. Most pastors have not been trained to lead. And then they start to lead and they realize, or they start to be a pastor and they realize that 70% of their job is in leadership. So many of the people on the leadership teams, they don't really understand leadership. So I used to complain about that a lot, and then I've realized that I need to shut up because that's how I make a living. So it's okay that people don't know how to lead. But leadership development is a big deal. It's different in a church context than it is in a secular context or in a corporate context, for sure. There's similar principles, but it's definitely a different animal. But anybody else? Why are you here? Good. Yeah. And the one principle that is so true in creating a right culture is that if you can create the right culture, you have leadership that gets developed at every level. So I think sometimes the focus is on the highest levels. It's on the macro level. What are we doing? And even that can be a problem. But what are we doing at the highest levels to make sure that we have the right leaders in place? And that's great. The problem is, what you really need is you need a pipeline, and you need to be able to build it in every area. Sometimes the worst thing that happens to a church or a church plant is that their strategy works. Because all strategies have growth components to them. Usually there's more people, there's either more people or more ministry that occurs, or both. So then if that works, but you're not developing leaders in the process, who's going to do the work? You're almost worse off because your numbers increased than you were before, because it was manageable before. So now we're like, yay, God, what do? We're worn out, we're exhausted. How do we make this happen? So good, we can talk about that a little bit. Anybody else? Yeah.
It's one thing to work with.
So you're trying to create common infrastructure, common language, common priorities. It sounds very Wesleyan, to be honest with you. It's good. Good stuff. Let me ask this. Yesterday, Dave said it. He was talking about how 80% of churches are either plateauing or they're in decline, which is tough. I mean, that's really hard. And a lot of those churches tend to focus on survival. And if you focus on survival, you won't, basically. I mean, you're playing not to lose instead of to win, so to speak. But he said 4% of churches are multiplying, and 2% of those, or 50% of those, so 2% of churches are really multiplying. The others are more like in church splits or whatever happens. So let me ask you this, and I want you to think through this. What makes it so that churches don't multiply? I mean, before we talk about the culture that we have to have, let's talk about what the obstacles are. Why don't churches multiply? What do you think?
Internal focus.
Okay.
Comfort, convenience.
Yeah. Yeah, the internal focus. I was part of a church plant about 25 years ago when I was like 6 years old. And what we decided was that everything was about outreach. Everything was about evangelism. All of our behaviors were about loving people, including people, getting them in and getting them saved, so to speak. You know, everything was about that. And it was probably the most fun ride of my life from a ministry perspective. I mean, it felt like we were like storming hell with squirt guns, kind of a feel. You know, it was just fun, energy. And then shockingly, God blessed it. It worked. You know, a lot of people came to faith. A lot of people were excited and growing, and the church started to get this stability need to it. And so we started focusing on, okay, or where are we doing all this? What kind of facility can we grow? What kind of programs do we need to establish so that people can continue to grow and we can reach more people? And all of a sudden, the focus became about programs and staff and structure and facilities. And all four of those things are good things. But they became the thing. And what we were set out to do, if you dig down deep, you could still find it, but it wasn't the predominant thing. And I think in a lot of our churches now, if you ask the average person that goes to church, what is this church about? Unfortunately, some of the first things that come out of their mouths are about programs. You know, what's your church? Oh, our preacher's great. This program is really doing great this way. Our kids' ministry is awesome. And all of those things are good, but if that's what they view the church to be, it's really hard to have a culture that multiplies, because all you're trying to do, because then all you need is resources to do it. And frankly, then people start to show up. What's the average attendance right now in the church? Have you seen some of the stats? That there's the same amount of people, and they have certain criteria for this, there's the same amount of people that are committed to church now as there were 10 years ago. But the numbers look like they're completely different. You know why? Frequency of attendance. 1.6 times a month, the committed people of church across our country go to church. And I think it's because they've seen what they feel is the most important thing. The culture of the church is all about the programs and the staff and the facilities. All those things that are really needed things. There's an internal focus that's really, really difficult. Somebody else, why don't churches multiply?
I feel like they have anyone to
send. Yeah. Yeah, it's a lack of resources to some degree, and it's the people side. It's like, okay, we could do something else, but who's going to go? Dave could go. Oh, we need Dave. He can't go. I mean, it's that kind of a feel too. Or I think sometimes we also look and say, we don't have, like when you're talking about leadership development, we look and we say, we don't have enough to take care of what we're currently doing. How could we start something else? That's an obstacle. What other obstacles do you see? Yeah, the other side of resources. I always say that there's enough money. There's enough money out there. Sometimes it's just really hard to find. But it's out there. And it's a real obstacle. It's a very real obstacle. Yes?
I find...
Yeah.
There's a
transition too. Well, and I think the challenge too is, how do you hold on... What's it in Ecclesiastes 7? It says, a wise person avoids all extremes. You know, hold on to one, don't let go of the other. And I think it's very difficult to figure out, okay, how do we grow people? I mean, a big part of growth is them doing evangelism, it seems like, or even investing into other leaders. How do you create culture where both are happening on a regular basis. If you notice, one of the themes that I hear from our international speakers at this conference is that what they're doing is immensely simple. I mean, everything is, you know, part of it, and you'll hear Ajay Lal, he hasn't talked yet, has he? I didn't miss that session. He talks about how they combine, basically. They take evangelism and discipleship and put them into one process. And I'm like, fascinating. Like, we don't do that here. And so it's hard to figure out when are we doing this and when are we doing that. And I think there is a difference between discipleship and sending and going and doing that type of evangelism. But I think the gap is way too big for us. I think there needs to be a lot of overlaps. And right now, I think one of the problems is that we don't know when to do which. It's hard. It's a real obstacle. Somebody else, any other thoughts on what obstacles might be?
65 poor people.
Right, right. And I think that what's interesting is that when you start something fresh, and those of you that have been in church plants or you planted the church, you know this. When you start something fresh, you don't have anything to lose besides maybe your pride and your dignity and your time and your energy and all that. But it's not like you're saying, okay, we might lose this if we do this. Okay? When you get something established and then you say, okay, now let's take the step of faith and expand from it, there's great fear that you're going to lose what you currently already have to do that. And I think that's a very real obstacle that people face. I think one of the obstacles that's also there is faith. I'm not going to get on a don't let me rant about this. I see more and more when I'm in different settings in different churches that they're not doing major initiatives that require faith. The question we're asking is, can we do it? Do we have the people? Do we have the money to do it? We don't? Okay, we're not doing it. And I'm like, wait, I'm not in favor of stupidity where you just do it and say, God will come through. I jumped off a cliff. God will catch me. No, but I think we should be about, and we want to create the culture that's such that if God doesn't show up, we're not going to win. We're not going to make it. It's not going to work if God doesn't show up. And I think oftentimes that fear, that's the real obstacle. I think we take it to an extreme and we say the only way that we'll serve God in this capacity is if everything's already taken care of ahead of time. And I don't know about you, but that's not been my experience in following Jesus. You know, I keep asking God for a map and God hands me a compass, you know, go this direction. I'm just like, yeah, but where do I turn? What's it look like when I get there? And God's like, go this direction. I mean, I think it's, but it requires a culture. It requires intentionality of culture too. Any other obstacles? I'm going to give you a couple that we haven't talked about. Yeah. Yeah. I've heard people say that too. There's been certain, Ed Stetzer was talking about all the churches that get planted in the South. I do a lot of work in the South and I'm like, man, there's a church on every block, but a lot of the churches are dead. I mean, there's no life in them too. The statistics of people who come to faith in the new, it's staggering how compared to in the, yeah. Yeah, and it's because, and some of it's because of the tradition, some of it's because of the ministry that they've already done, that's there. But yeah, in Chicagoland, I don't know what it's like where you live, but in Chicagoland, 70% of the people are unchurched, and 83% of the people are not in church on every weekend. And so when people say, do we really need another church? It's like, well, seems like it. Either that or we need to figure out some way to be reaching those people. Alan Hirsch says that only 40% of those people are actually people who would come to church anyway. We got to figure out another way to reach the other 60% or whatever. So anyway, that's a different subject. One obstacle that I see a lot, and it goes into culture a little bit, is that there's not a focused vision. We've lost sight of what the most important things are. I alluded to the programs being what drives the church sometimes. That's what people see it to be. I think relationships should drive the church. Relationship with God, relationship with each other, relationship with the world. Most churches say that they are very relational, and most churches are not. They use relationship as a means to make their programs happen? What if we had a culture that invested in people for the sake of investing into people? What if we found ways to develop leaders because that's part of their discipleship, not because we have a slot to fill or a hole that needs to be filled? And that's a culture shift. That's a value shift. That's saying at the highest levels of values, we value the development of people over function. And if you're going to have a multiplying culture where there's an excess of leaders, it's almost a counterintuitive thing. The more that you're investing in people relationally, the more leaders you have in place versus investing in leadership programs. Leadership programs are good, but they don't take the place of what you're trying to do culturally with relation. So I think the focus, oftentimes churches don't multiply because their focus is not on people, really, not on the investment into people. Does that make sense? I think another obstacle to, and we alluded to it a little bit, another obstacle that I see is that vision is not enough. You got to have a vision for it, but you need to have a plan. And I'll talk about values and narrative and behavior in a little bit, but I'll just say this about the narrative that we use, the language we use to describe the most important values, is that language, narrative needs to be both inspirational and operational. A lot of the people in our church, they would be developed into leadership if they understood things more from an operational end. I was with a pastor the other day, and I was trying to be nice. I'm not always nice. I try to be kind, but I'm very direct, and I'm working on it. My wife and I are working on me being less blunt with people. I say we're working on it. She's reminding me when I fail. I was with this pastor, and he said this, and I couldn't help it. He said, "When I say this is what we're going to do, our staff and our people, they pretty much do it. So we've got that going for us in our culture." And I'm like, "So you say it and it happens?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "No, it doesn't happen that way." And he said, "How do you know?" I said, "I know it doesn't happen that way. Because they don't know what to do. You inspire them with the what, but they don't know how. How does it work?" So we say, "Let's develop leaders. Everyone, will you develop a leader? You develop a leader? Everyone's going to develop a leader. Okay, ready, go." And then we all get on our own and we go, "Do you know how to develop a leader? I don't. Well, I'm going to try this." So everybody's doing all these different things because the leader cast vision on what to do and never told anybody how. And I think if you want to create a culture of multiplication, you need to have how as part of what everyone does. This is the... I'm a part of Community Christian. We need to have a Community Christian way. This is our way. This is our way of developing leaders. Everyone does it. If everyone does it the same way, if everyone has communication that's the same way, I think if you centralize some of the operational things, if you're trying to build outreach teams that reproduce themselves, and there's a common, not only a common language, but some of the activities you decide, some of the actions people take are all centralized. They do them in your own way, but they're all centralized. That's a big... When you don't have that, it's really hard to reproduce. Because what are you replicating? Theory. And theory doesn't replicate very well. Let me give you some enemies to growth, and then I want to talk specific about culture. But one of the enemies of multiplying is, and we've alluded to it, and I talked about it in the video a little bit yesterday, is complexity. Complexity kills. The more complicated you are... I've been in church plants that are 9 months old that are just unbelievably complicated. Here's what we do for this, and this is what we do here, and here's our system for this, and we don't have any way to do this. When people come to your church and they don't know what to do, they won't do anything. So you want to try to keep the biggest churches and the smallest churches. It doesn't matter. You want to try to keep everything really simple. What is your church about? What does your church do? I was in a church in North Carolina. I walked in. The pastor handed me a sheet of 99 ministries. And he said, these are all the things that we do. We used to be proud of this, is what he said. We used to be proud of this. Now they're just tired. And I said, how many people go to this church? And he said, our average attendance is about 350 people. And I'm like, and you have 99 ministries that you do. Who does them? That's what I want to know. They've made everything so complicated. So I think the more that you simplify, the more chance you have. So you want to start a church in Utah that's going to reproduce other churches? I think the more that you can say, this is what we're about, and then you can say yes to everything that fits into that. And then as people develop, everybody's going to have other ideas. And you can let them do it, but it doesn't become a part of who you are and what you're doing. Simple is really, really good. Another enemy is not just complexity, but it's control. Control is a big obstacle in churches for reproducing. And leaders in the church, we like to have things, we think it's good leadership when everything kind of reports to us and we work through it. I think those of us that preach or teach in any kind of context, I remember the first time that I started preaching, this was, I don't know, a long time ago. It was shocking to me because people came up to me afterwards and told me how great it was. And I had two simultaneous thoughts. One of them was really good, and one of them was really, really bad. The one thought that I had that was really good was like, wow, God can really use me this way. That's awesome. And then my other thought was, wow, maybe I am really good. Maybe I am all that. And that happens whether you're speaking or leading. And I think one of the biggest things that we have to do is we have to realize that it's not about us. And as much as we might want to say that, I think if you lead anything, you have to fight that. And if it never happens to you, then you're like so much more like Jesus than for sure I am. Or you're just completely non-self-aware. because those are issues. And so if you want to reproduce ministry, the part of the culture is, I've got to develop other people, and they are going to become maybe more known in this ministry, more known in this church. People are going to go to them instead of me. And you have to fight. Are you okay with that? And I don't care if you're leading a ministry or if you're in charge of the entire church. It's the same principle that gets in the way culturally of being able to, you know, I think a lot of churches don't develop leadership, really. They develop servants. And they don't develop leaders because if I develop Dave and he's better than me, then people will like Dave more than me. And that's yucky. I think that's the theological, technical term for it. Oh, you're great. Thank you. Where were you yesterday, man? You're so doing me right. He knows I've been out here yelling all day. My voice is cat. Does that make sense, that whole control thing? I mean, I'm doing what I said I wouldn't do, and that's to ramble at you. But any thoughts on that? I mean, on the complexity and the control. Does that resonate as something that's true? If so, how so? Yeah.
99.
Yeah. Well, and I think even if multiplication isn't what you're going to do well, the engagement of people doesn't happen. It's counterintuitive. I don't know if you've ever noticed that, like, most of the New Testament seems to be counterintuitive. Jesus' teaching is counterintuitive. Because you think the more things that you offer, the more people will engage with it, which is not true. Instead, everybody's mad because people aren't going to it. Instead of saying, okay, we're going to do these things and then we're going to work. How do we get people involved with it? How do we develop people while we're doing it? Because again, it's all about relationship. It's not about the program itself. So yeah, I think you're right. And they would have said with the 99, they would have said they don't do much of anything good. That was part of the reason why I was there, I think. But somebody else, any thoughts on the complexity control stuff? Is it? Yeah. Yeah. And that's, we're going to talk about that before we leave as far as how that works. But that's a big, I think that's a legitimate fear because someone can have the skills to do what you're doing or they do it better. But if they don't do it culturally the way that your church does it, I mean, I've had great leaders that have come with past experience, and I wasn't smart enough to ask, okay, why are you here and not there if that was such a great thing you were doing there? But they have the skills. But then when you see them do it, how they treat people how they make decisions, is that kind of stuff is so different than what your culture is, what your DNA is, that you have to almost backtrack and say, wait, I released you too early, not from a skill level. I mean, that you're always trying to figure out, do they need more skills? Do they need more spiritual grounding? Or do they just need to know the community Christian way or the Mariner's way or whatever it is? And they don't, because they're coming from a different context. That's a big deal. So anybody else with the complexities or control stuff? Here's a third one that I give you that's a real big challenge. Complexity is a systems issue, and you can fix that. You can set yourself up to alleviate or minimize complexity. Control is a personal issue that we always need to battle. Are we releasing? Do we need it to be about us? But the third one is more of a spiritual church-wide issue, and that's complacency. The third obstacle to multiplication is that, frankly, people don't care. So a lot of the internal, like when you were talking about internal perspectives that people have, where they just care about those who are already there, I think a lot of times what happens is that they just don't, they're not opposed to anything else, they just don't care. So I'm concerned about my family having the best situation in this church, even though there's people right over there that don't even know Jesus. And so that's a really, and you don't get people to care by preaching to them about how they should care. I mean, it's a good start. I mean, it's important to make sure that that's called out. But it becomes something, how do you change the spiritual landscape of the church to where their heart is soft towards people that are far from God? Their heart is soft towards, it's a heart, it becomes a heart issue. And that takes a lot. I actually knew of a church where they decided that their top value for this ministry season was to soften the heart of the church, which sounded like overly spiritual when they first said it. And then as they described it, it's like they were having separate prayer meetings and teams of people and town hall meetings, not to even talk about doing ministry, but just to talk about who God is and what God's about and all of that kind of stuff. It's like they had to go back to where they started. Because a lot of the church, when you plant a church, that's front and center. It's loving God, loving people, making disciples, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But it fades away if you allow it to. And then it's hard work to get it back. I mean, do you see some of those kind of complacency issues? Or is that just, it's in every church but the ones that you've been a part of? I understand. So let's talk about culture, unless you have questions and stuff for me a little bit more. You're like, I thought we were talking about setting up and defining a culture or shifting a culture. All of those obstacles need to be taken into consideration when you're intentionally designing a culture. And I think that's one of the most important components. Culture does not happen by itself. You have to be really intentional with it. And so just to review and then give you some specific action steps that you can take with it. Culture is at its beginning, it's about values. But the way that I define values is more about priority. What's the most important thing now? It's a vision question, but it's a deeply spiritual question. So you're asking God, what should we be about right now? I know of a church that decided to take 6 months to just ask that question of God, because they hadn't been. They'd been saying, what makes sense for us to do next? Or what's the play that we should try to run? Instead of actually saying, God, what do you have for us? What is it that we should do? And then once you establish that value, now I'm getting noise obstacles from above. Once you establish that value, then you have narrative as the second part. And narrative is it's partially the language you use to describe what's most important, but it's also the stories that live into what's most important. So a church decides they want to do kind of a missional outpost a couple of towns over. They don't want to just go and start meeting needs in this under-resourced area. They want to go and engage with the people there. But they don't know how to communicate it to the rest of the church, because the rest of the church is just very comfortable in what they're doing. They call themselves a country club church because they were right outside of a country club and they functioned that way. And so for them, they were like, oh, so we're giving money and stuff to those people over there? Oh, that's great. Let's do that. And we're like, no, that's not what we're trying to do. So what they did is that they went and they interviewed a couple people that live there. that they're building relationships with. They filmed it and said, talk to us about what your experiences are, but also what you see us doing as we're building relationships with you. And it was very powerful. They started talking about how their life is better and they were grateful and they're making friends. And then they showed that. And people are like, oh, I get what's most important. Why did they understand it? Because there was a story told to it. Not just a story of what had happened, but a story of what can happen. I think the narrative piece of what we're trying to create in a culture is that we're trying to create stories and verbiage that's powerful, that's inspiring, but also operational. So you want to expand in outreach? You know, some of it is maybe for people understanding what are the stories that are happening already in outreach. And then that's a way of mobilizing people, building that culture. I don't know if that fits or not, but it's just, that's part of it. And so we skip the narrative part in a lot of churches because we already talk really good. So we wing it, you know? So yeah, I'll get together with people and I'll tell them what our value is. I made a big mistake when I was in my pastorate where we were doing this major initiative, new outside of the walls of the church kind of thing. So I met with a group of people and I started talking to them about it. And they were people, younger people, worked with kids in ministry kind of stuff. And then I went to another group of people, older people, worked with adults, did different, and I used completely different language to describe this same value. And then I got them all together and I started talking about it and they were confused as heck. And I'm like, okay, I've got to be intentional about what's the language and what's the story I use. So that's the second part. And then the third part is behavioral patterns that fit with the values and the narrative you're using. What are the things that we would do that fit this value? So let me try to get a little bit more practical with the culture of multiplication. If you have a value of developing leaders and sending people to do ministry, whether that's planting another church, whether that's doing another multi-site thing, or just starting new ministries, if you have a value for that, there are certain behaviors that you need to put into place that align with it. So oftentimes we don't have those behaviors. What would those behaviors be? Here's a couple of them. One is that when you have people who are leaders, and I'll talk about how you get them to be leaders in a second. When you have people who are leaders or even staff people, we need to have a different criteria by which we put people into leadership. We put people into leadership based on how good they are at doing the thing that we're asking them to do. And that needs to change. I was in a pastor of a growing church. I hired a children's minister who is the best children's minister that you could ever find as far as working with kids. I mean, she's the Pied Piper. She would like get 50 kids around her, grade school kids, and they would all pay attention, be totally zoned into what, and I'm like, I can't do that with my two kids. She would get everybody like it. She was amazing. The day that she worked, she was on the platform and both of our services brought up all the kids and sang to them. I remember looking out, I saw this woman, this mom, she's like wiping tears off her face. And I'm thinking, I am the greatest pastor in the world because I hired this person. And 6 months later, I'm sitting across the table from her and we're having kind of a pre-exit interview. Because her idea of building a team and developing people was to get enough security people on the outside to keep the kids safe while she did all the work with the kids. I want to put people into leadership. I want to hire staff or even have staff that are unpaid, who are developers first, doers second. So if you want to have a culture that's multiplying, your leaders are developers first and doers second. Every ministry, any ministry, whoever's leading it, they don't have to be great at doing it. It helps if they know how to do it. But they have to be great at developing leaders. We put people into leadership positions because they're good. It's like my wife is a sales rep. Her boss keeps wanting her to be a sales manager. And she's like, no, I don't want to be a sales manager. I mean, it's more money, but I'm not a manager. I'm a salesperson. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. How much more money? But she, I mean, she, it doesn't qualify you to lead just because you're good at something. And that's it. You can design it that way. You can make it as the job description of anybody that's going to lead, any volunteer that's going to lead. Much less a staff person. that the number one job responsibility is to develop other people, to develop leaders, to develop a team, to do all of that. Secondly, is that it's really important to have, I think this, it's really important to have an apprenticing type of model that you use, that everybody uses. I told you I was a part of Community Christian and have worked with New Thing. We have a model, there's lots of models out there, but we have an apprentice model where literally you're investing in one person to become a leader, and you're investing relationally in them. It starts by coming to them and saying the most powerful four letters of the word of the alphabet put together. It's saying, I see in you. You know, I see this in you. And it's authentic. Don't manipulate it. But it's, I mean, if you see things in people, you're praying about that. You see things in people. I've done this where I've just seen great things and potential in people and said, I would like to invest in you. I'd like to spend time with you. And at the end of this, God willing, maybe you'd be a leader in our church. I've had people tell me, I'd love for you to apprentice me, invest in me. I'd love to spend time with you. I'd love to grow and learn. I'm never going to lead. I'm like, well, let's leave that up to God. And then halfway through the process, they change their mind. But I think so then what do you do with them? They watch you do it. And you talk about it. You talk about life. Then they start helping you do it. And you keep talking to them. Then they do it and you're helping them do it. It's simple. And then they do it and you're watching them. And then you release them, help them find someone else that they're doing it with. So all of a sudden it goes from someone who's not a lead and you invest some time, maybe 6 months of spending time with that person, and you're developing them to be a leader organically, experientially, and you're talking with them. It's a discipling process too, where you're talking about what it looks like to follow Jesus. You're talking what it looks like to lead people even as you're following Jesus. And then as you release them, you make sure that there's someone else that does the same process, you know, with them that they did with you. And if you have some kind of process like that, and you have it everywhere, so think about it. I mean, if you're investing in a person, and then after 6 months they become a leader, you're investing in another person, and they start investing in another person. It becomes this, if you pardon the term, it becomes this exponential type of thing. But it fits into your culture because you're going somewhere, you're doing something. I got a phone call a couple months ago. Can you come to our church and help us develop leaders? And I said, what for? And they said, well, we need leaders. We don't have enough leaders. And I said, to do what? And they were getting frustrated with me, understandably. They said, because we don't have enough leaders to do the ministry that we're currently doing. And I said, no, I can't help you with that. I said, if you want to define where you're going in a way that's reaching more people, that requires you to have leaders, I can do it. Because there's a reason why people aren't leading right now. It's because you're not going anywhere. Leadership is about moving forward and mobilizing people. So if you have developers instead of doers, and you have a model that's apprenticing people, the behaviors you have will match the values you have of reproducing and multiplying. And those two things are huge. The last behavior that I would give you in creating a culture of multiplication, I feel like I'm just talking really, really fast with like a fire hose. I hope it's all right. is to gather your leaders together on a regular basis. That can be per ministry, that can be per church, but gather them together on a monthly, for sure quarterly, but I'd even say monthly basis, and just cast vision for them. Remind them why they're doing this, that it's not about programs, but it's about transformation. It's about Jesus. Cast vision for it, and then teach them skills. I see this all over the place, where people step into serving and maybe even into leadership because they understand what needs to happen, but they don't understand how because we're not training them how. So teach them how to recruit people, how to talk to people. I was recruited. Not really. I had someone come to me and say, hey, I'm involved in this stuff and it's so much work and it's just killing me to do this. Would you think about joining us? And I said, so I can be exhausted like you? Why would I want to do that? I mean, that's his recruitment spiel. You know, come, we're exhausted. We're worn out. You too could be exhausted and worn out. It's like, no, we got to teach people even some of those basic skills. So I think those are some of the behaviors. So the value piece, if you can define it, with some kind of focused intensity, here's our top priority. And then if you can have stories and specific language that you choose around that value, and then you can have some of these behaviors, and there's others, then you have a chance to win with it. Okay? Any questions, thoughts on that? Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, how formal do you make that gathering? I think you wanna make it formal so that there's a rhythm to it. You know, so like every other month on the second Saturday from, 9 to 10:15 in the morning, this is what you do with leaders. But you don't want it to feel like a meeting. You want it to feel like a party where people are coming. One of the missing components in many cultures is celebration, just to consistently celebrate. We have meetings and they have agendas to solve problems. What if we started everything with celebrating? Where is God? What are we seeing that God's doing? Where are we winning? Those kind of things. But so if you create a gathering like that, we call it a leadership community. If you can create it and it's high energy, it's one of the best things that they do, even if it's a small group of leaders. It doesn't have to be. But you're just reminding them why you're doing it, and then you're given that they should walk out of there with some action. I love it at our church. We actually will say this: hey, the church at large doesn't know this yet, but since you're leaders here, we wanted you to be the first ones to know about it, because the people who are following you, they're going to ask you questions about it. So we want to make sure you're on board. People go, oh yeah, I'm important. I got that info. I mean, it really helps create that type of leadership vibe that you want. You want people wanting to be in leadership instead of people avoiding eye contact when they know you're on the recruitment hunt, You also want to be able to create a process where people know that they can become a leader by someone investing into them versus by someone assigning ship to them. So there's a process that you want to create. So, other thoughts? Yeah. That's a great question. And some of it is feel, some of it's more of an art than a science, but I think you're having the conversations all along. So you're saying, hey, I want to invest in you, and as I'm doing this, and as you progress, as you get a handle on what God wants for you, the vision is for you to do it with someone else too. And so let's talk about that. So even setting some time frames to say, hey, let's do this for a couple months, and then let's talk about where we are with this. And then there's been times when I have to slow people down and say, yeah, you think you're ready. Yeah, I don't think you're ready yet. And here's why. And again, you're kind and you're, but then they'll be like, okay, well, they'll trust you with it. There's been other times when I'm like, dude, you are so ready. And he or she will be like, I don't know, I'm a little, and so you're building confidence into them. But all along, you're talking about the process so that they know the expectation of them. I don't want to invest in anyone who it does not have an expectation clear in their mind that if they become a leader, that they will be expected to do it with someone else too. So that's, again, part of your culture that you're creating. This expectation of releasing, but also the expectation of multiplication. So you want to multiply it at the micro level. You want every leader to multiply themselves. And what happens is, what we do is we do an apprentice model, and they become, or some kind of developmental process where they become a leader, and then it stops. But if you're having the conversations all along, there's an expectation that they're going to end up doing it with someone else too. So I think you just talk about it very openly. And there's been times when I've had to say, it doesn't work 100% of the time. Sometimes you get involved with people at this level, you're investing in them at this level, and you realize, I don't really think that they should be leading right now. There's stuff in their life, or I had one person who just had a character issue that was so strong. They just got mad all the time, like really mad. Started yelling at people, yelling at their kids in church, and people like, whoa. And I'm like, and then they're like, okay, I'm ready to lead. I'm like, I don't think so. So it becomes a discipling process. I taught this model to a group of volunteer lay leaders and clergy together, which was fascinating. So I'm drawing it all out. I'm talking it through. And this elderly lady raises her hand. She's like, oh, and I'm like, yes, ma'am. And she's probably in her early 70s, I think. And she said, it seems to me that this is what Jesus did. invest in people and just help them grow, and then he sends them out. And I'm like, yes, ma'am, that's right. And then she looked at her pastor who was sitting next to her, a younger guy, and she looked at him and said, how come we don't do that? And which was great, so, because he was like all for it, but he's just trying to make sure that people in the church would be for it too. And so I think there's something about people are hungry for a relationship. People are hungry for that to be the drive, but they're so used to it being programmatic that if you can make that apprentice model feel like what it really is, which is, I'm going to invest in you and you're going to help me. I mean, some of our leaders, some of us, the next step in our transformation, our growth, is about actually one-on-one investment into other people. I grow the most when I'm spending time investing with people. And then they grow the most. And that's really the last point of content that I would give you. The biggest obstacles that I see are that we have forgotten about life change being the primary purpose for what we're trying to do in the development of leaders. We think it's about the functions of things, and it's about transformation. And I think that when you have a culture that values transformation above everything else, the transforming work of Christ that is not finished in us, when we value that and we teach that in narrative and we create behaviors of this kind of investment, I think then you're ready to multiply, no matter how big or small your church is, because you have so many people that are ready. Your leader readiness quotient goes sky high because the priority of transformation is what's driving people forward. I have a 21-year-old son who told me about a year and a half ago that it was a great line, totally. He says, Dad, I don't think I believe in church the way that you believe in church. And I'm like, this is awesome. What do you think I believe about church? But he says, he's a musician. He says, I love worship music. Our band plays some of that music. I can get it anywhere, anytime. I don't need to go to a program to get it. He said, and I've listened to sermons all my life. I've listened to you preach. Maybe that's the problem. I've listened to, and he's like, cocky 19-year-old. He's like, I know my Bible. He said, so I don't need to go to church, because that's what church is. I mean, that's his take. And I said, so what do you think church should be about? What would you want it to be? And he says, when I was in high school and I was in our D group, he called it, it's a discipleship group. He said, Wang was our teacher. We all knew each other. We all prayed for each other. We would wrestle with things together, and it was great. He says, and then when I went to Ecuador and to Mexico on those mission trips, we were making a difference, people right there. He's like, that was great. I said, so what you would want is those kind of relationships, and you want to go make a difference in other people's lives. He's like, yeah. So he wants community and wants mission. And I said, our perception of church is not that far off. But his perception was that all we cared about was whether he was showing up on Sunday morning. So you want to create a culture of multiplication? Use Sunday morning. It's a program. Use your other things. They're tools. They're tools for transformation. How does transformation occur? Relationship and mission. And then you'll find that your culture can multiply into other churches and all that stuff when that stays as a priority. Make sense? All right, thanks. Thanks for paying attention in an outdoor environment where there's lots of other activity going on.